Why are you interested in biometrics and privacy?
I find biometrics, Mel, to be extremely powerful, and the potential it has is, you know, the sky is the limit. But also, I'm very nervous because you're giving away key pieces of your identity or our identity, and people can exploit it. And that worries me. So the potential is amazing, but the downside is dark and scary. My guest today is Arun Ross. He's professor in computer science and site director for the Center for Identification and Technology Research. Arun, welcome to Life Meet Tech.
Thank you so much for having me, Prabhu.
Okay, it's wonderful to have you here. It was last week. I was going to Austin, Texas, and I'm a Delta frequent flyer. And I go up there and they said, what do you want to do? You want to use Face ID or you want to use your traditional sort of boarding pass? I chose Face ID. It was seamless. It was amazing. And I like the convenience. But we've had conversations before and you have identified the benefits. But you've also cautioned us about what we should think about when we use biometrics.
That's right.
Yeah?
That's right. Let me start with the definition for biometrics, just to set the conversation. When we say biometrics, we are trying to recognize people using their faces, fingerprints, iris, which is the colored portion of the eye, voice, and even gait, the way a person walks, or signature, the way a person signs a document, for example. So you're utilizing these biological attributes, if you will, in order to recognize an individual. So clearly, it's very convenient. I think many of us have smartphones that unlock when we gaze at the camera. The smartphone opens up and allows us access. So certainly, there is much convenience. But at the same time, as you point out, there are some concerns. What if I am in a public space and there is a camera watching me? And now what happens to my face images that are being acquired by this camera situated in this public space? Who has control over those face images? What can be done with those face images? So as you can see, there are some concerns. And what we do in our lab is try to develop techniques that can make the technology more accurate, while at the same time be concerned about the privacy aspects and the ethical aspects of this technology.
Tell me, what is the difference between the camera phone, it looks at my face and identifies who I am, and a television camera in the public square that's monitoring everybody who's walking by? Is there a fundamental difference between those two operations of the camera or the video that it captures?
Certainly. There is a world of difference. In fact, a camera situated on the smartphone is likely to acquire a face image and convert it into what we call as a face template, which is really a numerical description of your face. And that template is likely to reside in your smartphone in some secure place. Now, when I'm up and about walking in this public space, I don't know where the face images that are being acquired will end up residing. And so there is a fundamental concern about how much control do I have over my face image. So to answer your question, yes, there is a big distinction between these two use cases, even though both pertain to face recognition.
In one case, can we think of it as authentication and the other could be identifying, right? You've talked about this in the past. What is the difference between authentication and identification?
That's a great question because we do have to make that distinction between verification, what you're referring to as authentication, and identification. So in verification, I make a claim to an identity. I'm in some sense telling my smartphone, this is Arun Ross. Now verify if this is Arun Ross. But then in identification, I don't make a claim to any identity. It is almost as if I'm standing in front of the biometric system and asking the question, who am I? Not from a philosophical perspective, but, you know, my identity. And so the system goes ahead and searches its database and pulls out the closest match, which would then pertain to my identity as far as the system is concerned.
So let's talk about this identity part. So when you ask the system, who am I? essentially, that's running a query against a database of stored images. Is that correct?
That's right. The way an identification system works is when my face image is acquired, there are some computer operations that take place which convert my face image into a numerical vector, which we call this a feature vector. And then it takes that feature vector and compares it against all the templates in the database and pulls out that template which is closest to the feature vector that it acquired from me. And when they are sufficiently close enough with respect to a threshold, then it says it is a match.
But it's important to note that the match that the technology produces, it's still a probability, correct? It's not a 100% guarantee. It's somewhere in the 95th percent or 99% accuracy. Is that correct?
The short of it is it depends upon the quality of the image that is being presented to the system. If it is like a mugshot, as we would call it, or a very high quality, high resolution image, then it's very likely that the performance would even exceed 99%.
Hmm.
But if you're talking about what we call as in the wild images, often images that are acquired without any constraints, then the performance can steeply drop, maybe come down to 95. And then if it's of poor quality, then it can even further slide down. So there is a broad swath of performance numbers which are conditioned on the quality of the face image that is being presented to the system.
In this domain, we have heard about racism in face recognition. How does racism creep into face recognition?
So when you develop a face recognition system, you're utilizing what we call deep learning methods. These are techniques that can take some input data and classify them. Now, if the data that is used for training the system is biased, let's say one demographic group is overrepresented compared to another demographic group, then it is likely that the face recognition system will not perform well on that demographic group that is not well represented in the training data. So this results in what we would call demographic bias. But that's not the only reason why bias can be induced. It also depends upon the developers of the technology. And so there is much work needed. And the good news is that researchers are no longer oblivious to this problem. They understand the importance of this problem. They understand the implications of making errors that are demographically biased. And so many, if not all, in the computer vision and biometrics community are beginning to pay careful attention to these type of biases and trying to mitigate them before the systems are deployed in real-world applications.
I'm wondering why someone should worry so much about bias in face recognition.
You must have heard the case of Mr. Robert Williams just around the corner in a suburb of Detroit, who was misidentified by a face recognition algorithm and subsequently, without any further context, was arrested and spent overnight in jail. Eventually, he was released. And he happened to be an African-American. And so you can clearly see that the algorithm made a mistake on a specific demographic group. And further evaluations would substantiate that some algorithms are vulnerable to these biases. So which means certain demographic groups are disproportionately affected by the deployment of this technology. And this is the reason why we as researchers pay very careful attention to this. And that becomes even more significant in a society like ours, where there is diversity. And our intention and desire is to see that this type of technology is performing well across all demographic groups, and that when people use the technology, they are not sidelined because of the color of their skin, for example.
It's used in crime fighting, facial recognition. It's also used in public safety. Under these circumstances, then, it's really important that we look at the social and cultural dimensions of the technology, correct?
That's right. Crime fighting, you mentioned that as one particular application. At the same time, there are some civilian applications, consumer applications, so a broad swath of applications. So if you take something like voice recognition, or really I must say speaker recognition, trying to recognize people based on their voice samples, you can imagine that because of the different dialects, different accents, different languages, the sometimes speaker recognition algorithms can stumble. And so one must consider these other dimensions, the social dimension, the cultural dimension, because context is very important. What is expressed in one language might sound very different when expressed in a different language. And that can often impact the performance of speaker recognition algorithms, because now you're no longer just talking about biometric samples. You're talking about dialect, you're talking about accent, you're talking about emotions, and you're talking about so many other factors which are psychophysiological that impact these biometric samples. And increasingly, biometric researchers are becoming aware of that, and researchers have to pay careful attention to these factors rather than sweeping them under the rug, so to speak.
When well-meaning people try to use facial recognition and they make mistakes, it has grave consequences because the wrong person is implicated, and that's one of the challenges. What about rogue actors who hijack or steal the data and they create deep fakes, and it seems like it's my voice, but it's really not. I didn't say that. Somebody manufactured that, right? Or stitched together various utterances I've made.
That's right.
To make me say something that I didn't say. Tell us about deep fakes.
That's right. Yeah. What is a deep fake? In simple words, it is a digital image, or sometimes even a digital sound, that is created synthetically in order to represent a certain individual, but it's really not that individual. So it can create synthetic faces through a process called face swapping, or it could introduce fake voice samples. And you can see several examples on the web, even now pertaining to the Russia-Ukraine war. And then there are deep fakes of Tom Cruise, deep fakes of Mark Zuckerberg, and the list goes on. And this is where one has to be very careful, because deep fakes can be used to spread misinformation. So now in our lab, for example, we are developing techniques to detect deep fakes in order to be able to automatically review an image and see if this is a real image or if it is a synthetic image. So this has also changed the scope of biometrics, because now you have these synthetic identities that do not pertain to anyone on planet Earth that are placed on the web. They do not correspond in many cases to real individuals. If you actually just type in thispersondoesnotexist.com on your web browser, you will begin to see synthetic images created by GANs.
I've seen that website. That's an amazing site. I mean, those images are so real. So if I were to present an image from a deepfake and another image of a real person, can a computer program algorithm detect which is a real person and which is a synthetic person?
That's right. We use a deep neural network to take in an image and then make the assertion. And so therefore, the issue of finding out which neural network actually generated that image becomes a very pertinent question. The goal in many cases is to combat misinformation, because deepfakes can be used in a concerted manner to spread misinformation. And so there are multiple reasons why detecting deepfakes accurately is a very important problem.
What about privacy? Yet another dimension of this is, if somebody steals my basic biometric identity, they can do anything with it. And how do I protect my biometric data, knowing that the technology is fascinating and there is a big upside to all of this?
Sure. I think one important aspect is that the responsibility falls on vendors and others to ensure that the data that we provide is encrypted. That means you protect it, and you cannot review the contents of the template unless it's decrypted. Another concern is that someone might create a fake fingerprint and then place that fake fingerprint on the sensor. You can read articles about this in Japan, in Brazil, and in many other parts of the world, and here in the U.S., where people have attempted to use fake fingers or fake faces, that means face masks, mm-hmm. or sometimes even some cosmetic contact lens for their eyes, in order to try to circumvent a biometric system. And we have an ongoing project where we are trying to detect these type of attacks. We call them as presentation attacks, because someone is presenting something to the sensor. And I think the good news is that increasingly these systems are becoming more and more secure. At the same time, I think your question was, what can we do about it? I think we must request vendors and others who take our data, request them for the information about how they are securing our data. I think there should be some degree of accountability there. And I think that information is going to be extremely important.
So I'll go back to my original question. when you board a plane. These days, you can use face recognition. Would you be scared? Should we be scared? Do you use that?
So I have used it. Yeah. I think you're referring to Delta Airlines.
Delta, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've used it multiple times, and it is very convenient. And if I have the assurance that they're not going to store my face images for long, I find it easy to use. I think that is another aspect. When does the data get destroyed? And if there is some guarantee that the data is used only during the scope of my flight or the scope of my travel, I think I would definitely use it because of its convenience. And certainly in some airports, I don't have to interact with an individual. I just have my passport, show my face image, and the gates open up. So there are some tremendous advantages in especially the travel domain, where biometrics will likely play a very significant role.
We hear a lot about ClearView AI. What is it and why is it in the news so much?
So ClearView AI has about 20 billion face images in its repository. And these face images have been scrapped from public websites, social media websites, which means you can build profiles of individuals based on these images that are scraped from the web and stored. And so potentially, if I were to give a face image now, ClearView can run it through their database and immediately tell me who I am. So clearly you can see the concerns revolving around such a use case for face recognition. But more recently, I think ClearView AI has decided that they would only sell their technology to law enforcement agencies, at least within the US. And there are some states like Illinois in which ClearView cannot supply their algorithm to even law enforcement agencies, I believe, for the next 4 or 5 years. So yes, the concern there is that anyone can be identified at any time because you have this massive database of individuals all over the world. And therefore, you are walking across the street, someone takes a picture of you, they can find out who you are in principle if they have access to the ClearView AI technology. So this is where privacy comes into play. Say when you post your face image or when I post my face image in the web, I never expect a third party to download those face images and worse, use it for purposes far beyond what I had anticipated. This is where function creep comes in. By function creep, I mean you supply the face image for a specific purpose, but it's now being used for purposes that you never signed up for. The technology itself, as I said, is exciting. But it must come under some well-drafted regulation so that it's not misused and abused by negative actors.
Some cities have enacted legislation that forbids the use of face recognition by law enforcement. What are your thoughts on that?
I think there should be more discussion. When you're trying to locate a missing child or when you're trying to locate a perpetrator of a crime, in some cases, group of individuals attacking a certain institution, etc. If they have to be located, then clearly face recognition technology has some benefits. So careful deliberation has to precede any action. And it has to be done in a manner that highlights the benefits of the technology, while at the same time speaking to the dangers of abusing the technology. I think as we increasingly use this technology, we are beginning to see many of the advantages. But if we don't regulate the technology, then there is going to be grave danger and it can be heavily misused or abused. So I feel that there should be a measured discussion before making any decisions about banning the technology without any context.
Give me the best case scenario for biometrics. Let's say we have enlightened policies and people are using it well. They are quite literate about digital literacy and aspects of their own security. And everyone steps up and let's look at the utopian scenario. What can this kind of technology lead to? What kind of future do you envision for it?
I think the way I see it is that people will have the option of using biometrics in many scenarios, but they should also have the option of using something else. And so the ideal scenario would be that I wake up in the morning and I walk through my door and my car opens up somehow. I don't know, maybe it just saw me walking toward it. It gets cold in Michigan, so I can't imagine removing my gloves and placing my finger on the sensor. But somehow it has recognized who I am. And then the moment I get into the vehicle, it adjusts all the parameters of the vehicle, the configuration of the vehicle, the audio system and the seat and so on. And then when I exit the car, well, it parks itself. and then I'm able to walk into my office. I don't have to search for the keys that I need in order to let myself in to my office. And so some kind of seamless way in which all these things are done. Well, at the same time, Prabhu, I feel that we should have an opt-out clause. Not everyone is going to be comfortable with this technology for various reasons. I would always say, yes, the technology is very powerful. But at the end of the day, any decision that is rendered by a biometric system in a high-stake application should be reviewed by a human. In other words, we don't want to completely eliminate humans from the loop. We want a collaboration between man and machine, between human and machine. In that way, you have a better outcome of the technology. But I'm very excited about the potential of biometrics. But at the same time, I would like to see that people have the option in their day-to-day activity, whether they want to opt in for certain cases, and in other cases, they want to opt out.
Researchers from DeepMind recently made an announcement that they have cracked it and they are very close to replicating human intelligence. So this is the general AI argument. I know there are many skeptics and many computer scientists would probably push back. But still, what is the cautionary note there? I think it goes back to your point about that humans should be in the loop. But
Right. Is
it possible, though, would there be a time, this point of singularity kind of idea, when machine agency has sort of taken over human agency?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we mediate that in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it kind of wanders into the philosophical arena as well. I think what constitutes a human and what constitutes human intelligence is still an active area of research. I think one must state that we ourselves haven't fully comprehended what human intelligence is. I think what we're really saying is that we have developed agents that can very well mimic the way humans do things and perhaps even how humans think through various things in their life. But again, there is a difference between the two. And this is the reason why a collaborative environment would be better. But I want to say something else here. There are certain activities in which machines can be much better than humans. And we should not ignore that. And there are several examples, being able to do the same thing over and over again with the same accuracy, for example. And so one must concede that there are activities where machines are going to be better than humans. At the same time, there are other activities in which humans in groups are better than machines. So one must make a distinction on a case-by-case basis. But giving complete control over machines is something that I'm not in favor of. I think and I feel very strongly that humans have to be involved in many tasks. But the bottom line is it's on a case-by-case basis, application-by-application basis.
So keeping humans in the loop is a good idea.
Yeah, Prabhu, are there instances in your life when you said, I really need biometrics and I need to recruit Arun to my department?
Yes, I've said that many times. And that's when I go through customs or immigration in India or China or Japan. But amazingly, last time I was in China, I think, I saw a camera take a photo. And by the time I went to the immigration desk, they already had my record and everything. In record time, I was out of there. So you've already made a difference in my life, Arun. Arun, thank you for joining me on Life Made Tech. This has been a terrific conversation. And thank you for your insights, expertise, and the information.
No, I very much enjoyed this session talking to you. Very insightful questions, a broad swath of questions. You made me think. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to engaging with you further, especially on this topic of biometrics and privacy.
Thanks, Arun. Life Meet Tech is presented by WKAR in association with Michigan State University. Executive producer, Melanie Paul. Audio engineer, Drew Hill. And hosted by me, Prabhu David. Please subscribe wherever you're listening right now so you don't miss an episode. And I'll see you next time on Life Meet Tech.